players like talking about what they do.
Yeah, they like being listened to, and because they get enough people, fans or reporters, who think they know what they're doing out there, who think they know a lot more than we do. And I think to come to have someone ask them about how they do what they do, how they became great, how they mastered that, I don't think the players hear enough of that, of those how questions, those why questions.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week from a distance, a safe more than 6 foot distance, by New York Times national baseball columnist Tyler Koeppner and author Tyler Koeppner of the book K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches, one of the best baseball books of the previous year, and now out in paperback just in time to satisfy the baseball vacuum that we have right now. Tyler, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be back. I think our last podcast together was after Game 7 of the World Series, right? In the little media, I don't know what the closet there where they kept all the media guys. But
the auxiliary media workroom and storage room.
Storage room, right. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, no, it's good to be here. Good to be talking baseball.
Where would you have gone for opening day had there been an opening day coming on the horizon here next week?
Houston. My birthday was supposed to be the original opening day, March 26th. Usually a boring late spring training birthday, but this year it was supposed to be opening day. But I know I had a plan to, I was, you know, reservation to go to Houston to see their opening series with the Angels, and then to go out to Oakland to see their first road trip. Not anymore.
What instead, what will you be doing?
On March 26th?
Well, just in the coming week. March 26th, first of all. You'll be at home. Will you be riding baseball, playing a dice baseball game? MLB The Show?
I don't know. It's spending a birthday in quarantine. We're all still working. I've been, trying to keep tabs with MLB on the latest whatever's going on there. Not a lot, obviously, but I've written a couple times this week. Working on my next book and putting out calls for that. I got a couple calls the last couple days, and I'll say put a couple more lines in the water and see who fights. How it goes. I'm doing a lot of NBA video games with my son, and I've actually beaten him a couple times. but what we do is I get to pick both teams. So I pick like anybody I want in basketball history. Then we upped his skill level just a little, and now he beats me almost every time. But I did win once. I always use Shaq and Bird, and Chris Mullin is deadly. And then the other two I just sort of, I rotate in. He's like, hey, you don't use Michael Jordan. I'm like,
You draw the line at Michael Jordan.
I may have to bring in Jordan and Steph Curry, because Shaq's all I need down low, and I just, if I can survive the perimeter with a lot of good 3-point shooters, then I can sort of fake my way to a possible victory.
We're going to spend some time talking about your book, but I want to first ask you, what are some of your initial thoughts on the baseball related stories that could happen without baseball games? Like, what are something, the moment that the season was postponed and then opening day was kicked back another 8 weeks, possibly, at least, and we're looking at multiple months without baseball, or at least without regular season baseball, what were some of the things that leapt to mind immediately as far as questions or stories that baseball presents?
That's the question everybody's asking, right? I mean, I can always go back to historical baseball stuff, the stuff we all missed and all that. But as far as the stories of the now, never had to deal with it. I mean, I came in who, I believe you and I both graduated college in 97, which was a great time to start covering baseball as a beat writer, because the strike had been over for 2 years, and you didn't have to, we haven't had to worry about any work stoppages ever, labor or otherwise. I mean, the only work stoppage was for a week after 9/11, and that was, you know, obviously a horrible outlier, but they just essentially, a week later, they just picked back up, packed on the week games at the end. Well, series ended November 4th instead of October or whatever, but like, it was a 1 week disruption in games. And now we have this longest disruption of a season since 95, and I don't even know if we'll get in the 144 games they got in 95, so then you're talking since 94. But the biggest difference in 94 now, remembering into the sand, is that, you know, 94 you were just mad all the time. Everybody was sad to not have baseball. You were just mad because these, you know, players and owners couldn't figure out how to share the money. And now there's no one to be mad at it at all. It's just everybody's really sort of bummed and gloomy about it, because nobody knows even when it's going to start up again. But I don't know the stories too, man.
Well, what are the questions that you have? Like, do you wonder? Like you brought up 94, 95, and you're exactly right. People were angry, and so did they punished baseball by not being interested in baseball. Mm-hmm. If this feels way differently, then does baseball's return become this symbol of a country's return, and all of a sudden being at the games again is cathartic? You know, how do players stay sharp? What happens to service time? I mean, like, all these things just kind of bouncing around in the head.
Right. Yeah, the service time, the draft. I mean, I feel like, you know how it is. Anytime there's a disruption with a guy's schedule, even if he's not signed in spring training and he gets a spring training late and then he has a bad season, it's like, well, he had a different spring training than usual.
Right.
Or like anybody who ever plays in the WBC and then gets injured later, it's always like, well, he played the WBC, therefore he got hurt. So like any kind of injury or weird performance this year, like everybody's going to have a built-in rationale is that, you know, well, it was different spring training, you know. But I do worry about that, like, legitimately for the players, the pitchers, because pitchers are such finely tuned animals. Like, yeah, you build them up in a specific way for a specific job to do over 6 months, and now all of a sudden, when they're at the point where they're ramping it up to whatever they've been at, 50, 60 pitches, now you got to ramp it all back down and then put it back up again. Like, it's just, it's going to be weird. Like, no one's really experienced a long-term interruption during spring training. So, I wonder how they're going to stay sharp enough to be ready to go. Because, like, you know, you can just return the basketball season, and as long as the guys are still in shape, they can just play basketball. But pitchers' arms don't work that way. And that's one of the reasons baseball is so great, but it's also what makes it complicated right now.
I mean, I think it's really interesting because in this age when everything has numbers crunched and overanalyzed and data-driven, that some teams, some multiple teams, are going to be able to find a way to create an edge during this period by how they prepare and have their pitchers sort of maintain a steady level without overusing them, but while keeping them ready. I mean, is that possible that this becomes some area where a team finds a competitive edge?
Well, could be. I mean, you know, whichever team devises the best plan for its players, if some team try something that doesn't work or leads to some injuries, then it'll work against
them. Right,
I think the problem is that they just don't. Nobody knows how long it's going to take. So you're really operating with only half the information. You know you're out, but you don't know how long you're going to be out.
Right.
I would imagine that second part of the equation would have to have a major impact on the answer. So I guess they all have to have plans, but it's all kind of incomplete guesswork.
Do you think there's a team, you got to travel, how many teams of the 30 did you get to see before spring training came to a halt?
Well, I saw most of them. I mean, I was out in Arizona for 2 weeks. there was only two teams who I didn't lay eyes on at all, the Mariners and the Giants. But I saw I saw everybody else. I saw the Rangers play and the Padres play. I didn't go to their clubhouses, but I talked to a couple guys around the team. So let's call that 13 out there. And then in Florida, I saw the Nats, the Astros, Mets, the Red Sox, Phillies, Yankees, the Pirates. So that's seven. So I've seen like 20 teams. I've done 20 or 30.
So yeah, so two-thirds of them. So I'm going to ask you this question, and then I'm going to give you time to think about it as I read the sponsor. Do you think there's a team that you saw or that you kind of prepared for the season, that you kind of looked into how they might do this season, that would benefit from a shortened season? Like one that just stands out as a team that might, over 162, start to fray or maybe not be as good, but say over 120, 100, now all of a sudden looks like a much better team because of either they're getting players back from injury, or, you know, given this break, or because of the way their roster's set up. Just think about that, and I will tell people about our sponsor, Closets by Design. Imagine your home totally organized. Closets by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% off, plus an additional 15% off Closets by Design. That's 314-733-9855. Again, Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. Closets by Design, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. So, Tyler, is there a team that you think of that might benefit from, like, having a shortened schedule?
Well, I think the Yankees, because they were scheduled to start out the season with four really important players hurt. They won't get Severino back, obviously, after Tommy John, but you know, this gives time for Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton to get into game shape, and also James Paxton. So I think that helps them. But I also think the Oakland A's, when you look at the A's, one of the things that gets you excited about them on paper is the potential of Jesus Luzardo and AJ Puck in rotation. But you wonder, like, would they really be able to pitch a full season from late March all the way into late October, given that, you know, they're young and they've had injury histories? You know, probably not. It probably would take a lot of creative management. But I think now this opens up a more realistic possibility of seeing some of these dynamic young pitchers actually pitching in October or November or whatever it turns out to be. So I think some teams like that maybe has questions about innings limits and stuff, possibly that won't be as big of a deal. And maybe Houston, because, you know, Verlander is down now because it's groin surgery, I think, in 6 weeks of recovery, but they're not going to be playing in 6 weeks probably. So, you know, that helps the Astros, because they don't have to miss all those Verlander starts. And also, maybe when the Astros come back, maybe people won't be as angry at them as they would have been. But I still wonder about their pitching beyond that. But no, I mean, those are a couple that come right to mind. But I think a lot of teams could probably benefit because of the pitching aspect of it.
You brought up Houston, and I wanted to ask you about that. Do you think that this pushes what Houston did? You kind of touched on that there to the periphery. You think it's going to be bygones, all forgotten? And will there ever be resolution with the Red Sox investigation, or is that also going to kind of get punched to the back seat because of a much bigger deal, much more, you know, national big deal in the crisis we have at hand?
Yeah, you really wish they had just resolved that one, because it's crazy to have that lingering so long. But I don't think people will forget about the Astros. I mean, I think once we get back to somewhat normal, if we can say that, I think fans will want to be fans, and they'll want to revive all that stuff. I mean, they still haven't played in the regular season since all this came out. So I think it might be a little less passionate, a little less long-lasting, maybe. But I think if you go to a ball game, that means that we're out of position in the country where it's safe to get together again. And you'll want to just try to enjoy your time at the ball game like you normally would, and I think every second of the Astros get through quite a bit this year.
I wonder if the frustration, anger, whatever it manifests itself against the Astros becomes a bonding experience for people. You know, like back at the baseball game, but at least we can all agree that we don't like the Astros kind of thing.
Right, right. At least we can have a common enemy in this time of national unity.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Now, the Astros are doing a lot of good things. So a lot of their players are doing a lot of good things in the community and, you know, for those affected by all this.
Yeah.
So, you know, I never thought of the Astros as bad guys. You know, they obviously ran a scheme that, there's a lot wrong with them, but there's also a lot of good stuff that they were doing, and I just hope eventually, historically, that doesn't all get swept away, because there was a lot to like about the Astros as well.
Where were you the day spring stopped and the delay started?
Luckily, I had just come home. I had come home on that Saturday night from Brewers camp, finishing up for 2 weeks in Arizona. And I was supposed to go back on Wednesday, and then when they closed the clubhouse, the media, I was like, well, this isn't going to be that productive. Let's push it back. Instead of spending 10 more days in Florida, let's spend 7 days in Florida. So I was going to go down over the weekend, like the next Saturday. So it's going to be like a week here. And then by then, it was everything had gone packed up and gone home for the most part. So there was no need for me to go back down there anymore. So, yeah, I've been here since March 7th.
What was that like for you as, you know, they closed the clubhouse and then everything accelerated? What was it like for you from, you had kind of a bird's eye view then, not being kind of on the ground. How did that week play out for you?
Well, it was weird because, you know, for one thing, like, you know, it'll be 30 years this month that I've been doing interviews. And I've been in the BBWA for 23 seasons. So, you know, you really start to enjoy stories that you've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And this would have been something that I'd never seen before. No one had ever dealt with this before. A pandemic really, obviously it was building, but the severity of it sort of rushing to the forefront over a 3-4 day span. And I wasn't on the scene because maybe not you, but a lot of writers did get a little bit of time at home during spring training, and that was just happened to coincide with my little stretch at home. So, yeah, it felt a little weird not being down there to be part of the story on the scene. But then again, I was much, much happier on the human level to be home and not have to worry about traveling.
It just seemed like probably it happened very fast. And I wondered if you had that sense that, because like being there at the time, it was like these like incremental steps that every team was taking or Major League Baseball was taking. But that was partially because every 15 minutes felt like different, like something was being thrown at us. Even to the point like where that Thursday that they eventually did cancel spring training, we all knew they were going to cancel spring training. There were reports that baseball had ceased baseball operations, and yet I was watching baseball operations. I was watching a game. I was covering a game that was still going on, and it just was this like surreal experience to not be able to step back and watch it from the appropriate distance like reporters usually do. It was like in it because we were like, well, how are you making these decisions? And, oh, these decisions impact us because if you're going to play a game, I got to go cover it for the newspaper. So I got to be in that crowd. It doesn't feel right. We shouldn't be in this crowd. The Florida government just really told us weird. Not to be.
That was super weird from a distance because I was trying to track the story of the owners, you know, meeting and their decisions about canceling it. Mm-hmm. And you know, they were playing a game, and James Wagner was there, my colleague and with you, and people I knew were covering this game. And you knew, what did Matt Carpenter say afterwards? It was the most
worthless game in baseball. No, most meaningless. The most meaningless game in baseball history.
Yeah, it was spring training anyway, over a season that you knew was going to be suspended within minutes. So it was just really weird. But yeah, the pace of all this, like, we went out to the movies one of the nights, and by the time we came back, you looked at the phone, and it's like, you know, the president announced a travel ban, Tom Hanks has the coronavirus, and the NBA is shut down. Yeah, because Rudy Gobert has like, whoa, wait a minute, this all just happened, you know, in the time span of going to the movies.
Yeah, it was tough to watch. So back to it was tough to keep up with. It wasn't just tough to watch. It was tough to keep up with because from my point of view, to being down there, it was like, okay, we start plotting when reporters need to leave and how to do that, and you know, what do we cover if there's not baseball, and how rapidly should we be concerned? It was a very I'll never forget it. It was a little bit but this building national fear and concern
right.
that was coming with a pandemic. So I want to talk baseball too, and funnel into your not just like the pause of baseball or how baseball stopped, but the actual like stories that you got to tell in spring, and then also like move into talking about K and the paperback that's out and perfect reading time for opening day without baseball. Let me start here. One of the stories you did was visiting with the Reds and their adoption, I think that's the right word, their adoption, maybe even they've acclimated Driveline and some of the leaders there into their pitching program. Could you describe what you saw there and how the Reds intend to make that work?
Yeah, it was really interesting because I feel like the Reds recognized that they were a little bit behind a couple of years ago, and they made a huge push to sign Derek Johnson away from the Brewers. Seeing how successful the Brewers were, it was a smaller market team getting a lot from their pitchers and just paying a lot of money for a coach. And they loved what Johnson did, and Johnson had an associate who he had worked with, former Vanderbilt pitcher who pitched briefly for the Reds. And Yankees named Caleb Cotham, and Caleb had done some work at Driveline, and of course they got Trevor Bauer later that season. He knew Kyle Bodie from Driveline, but it struck me a lot, Derek, like the way Bill James was just sitting out there for so many years, writing all this logical stuff that could help teams, but teams just kept him at a distance because he wasn't of baseball. He was an outsider, and Kyle has always been somewhat of an outsider as well. He's outspoken, but he was doing something that was really connecting with player pitchers in particular and making them better. And so, why not try to get him for yourself? I mean, it made so much sense. He was already consulting for other teams. I remember seeing him in spring training last year, doing some work for the Rangers, and he had helped out here and there, but the idea of hiring him full time was catching on last winter. I mean, Kyle had at least three choices of full time jobs. I mean, he still does the Driveline; he's still president of Driveline, but he has at least three choices from big league teams, and he chose the Reds. The Reds really liked him because they were surprised when they dealt with him that he wasn't abrasive and he wasn't all about the numbers and everything, that he really recognized the value of a coaching tree and of kind of having a feedback loop of information among all the coaches. Because he talked a lot about like how to reach kids and how to because kids this generation have so much information. They crave it. They like it. They enjoy it. They don't resist it. They know it can make them better, and it's just what they're used to in this world now that they're growing up in. So he has seen that, because he has so many college kids come through his program, but he also knows that you still have to communicate this information differently to each kid, and so that's a big part of his emphasis is knowing how to speak to each of these kids and how to get through to them. And I think it's going to be great for the Reds. I mean, they don't have a very good farm system right now, at least according to the experts. They need to build that up. He's going to be spending a ton of time in the low minors trying to give them the kind of pipeline that a team like the Reds can really use. So I think it's great. I think it's great because he's not just a strictly numbers guy. It doesn't always work. I mean, like last year, the Phillies and the Angels and the Mariners hired pitching coaches with very little background, very little playing background, extremely data-driven. And the Phillies and the Mariners and the Angels all have new pitching coaches this year. It doesn't always work. It doesn't work without the communications component. And that's one thing that Kyle, for all of his outspokenness that people might worry about, is actually really good at communicating with people one-on-one.
Yeah, the Mariners are an interesting case for Cardinal fans because the Mariners hired Paul Davis out of the Cardinal system to go then work with the Mariners, who also at one point in time last year, I think half their pitching staff was former Cardinals.
So, yeah.
You know, so they did have Mike Leake for a while. They didn't, you know, and then Marco Gonzalez and Sam Tuivalala. They had a handful, particularly, but Marco Gonzalez stands out for obvious reasons, as he was a Cardinals draft pick and then debuted within 12 months of being drafted out of Gonzaga. So, you know, the Paul Davis going there, now Paul Davis is with the Braves. But, you know, you're right. I mean, it was like kind of a non-traditional hire, but he was heavily involved in what the Cardinals were doing. What the Cardinals really tried to expand this year, not quite driveline-esque, but far more tech-oriented, more so on the hitting side this year, because they finally feel like they had a guy who would use it and had reason to then invest in a lot of this. I wondered, like, when you think about, like, the way we talk about pitching now through the driveline angle and the pitch craft angle and all this, how you look at that with the research and interviews you did for your book as the tailwind. Like, you know, do we talk about pitching more as if, you know, like it's an algorithm, as opposed to in your book you capture so well how we spoke about pitching as a legend, you know, where pitches come from and the novelty of a guy, you know, fiddling around with a pitch until it works, as opposed to running it through, you know, high-speed cameras and running it through its gyro through, you know, a small little portable radar. You know, are we losing some of the romance of pitchcraft?
Maybe somewhat in the passing down of heirlooms from one pitcher to another. But I think there's always, I think it all stems from the same mindset. Which is just trying to experiment and innovate and get the most out of your arm while you still have the chance. I mean, that's one thing I really noticed, and I think that was a common theme throughout all 10 chapters, was that this all comes from pitchers trying to get better. Most of it is, you know, guys who were already professional quality. It wasn't like just some, you know, a high school kid learning a pitch and zooming to the top. Like, it's usually guys who are already pretty good and just trying to distinguish themselves from the pack. And I think that's what all this is all about. All this driveline stuff, all this, you know, Rapsodo and Edgetronic cameras and all this high-tech stuff, it is coming from the same point of view, which is just how can I get better? And now you have a more accurate way to figure that out.
Of the people you spoke to for your book or the pitchers you got to know through it, so not just, but like pitchers in the past who you weren't able to speak to, but all the research that you did, was there a particular guy you think who would have gone full gusto into this stuff from the past? Like would Steve Carlton have been at driveline in the winter? Would Greg Maddux have been even filthier as a professor with access to this stuff?
I think some of them. I mean, Carlton was way ahead of his time in terms of the training methods.
Yeah.
But he was very open to doing things differently and thinking differently. You know, that was certainly a part of what made him great. You know, one guy who I always think of in those terms is Johnny Sain. I mean, Johnny Sain was so far ahead of the rest of the coaching world. You know, he really individualized it for pitchers, which these guys all talk about now as being a key. And Johnny Sain just had such a curiosity about the craft, about how do balls spin, how do pitchers understand spin better. I mean, that was stuff that he was doing that no one else was thinking about or talking about, like understanding
spin and the properties of the baseball as it goes through the air. You know, he created a little spinning device that you could hold in your hand so you could see it up close and understand what that spin does and what kind of spin you're trying to produce. He basically popularized the slider, the so-called short curve, at the time, just experimenting with different ways to make the ball break. So I think Johnny Sane, with access to this stuff, would have been all over. He would have been like Brent Strom, you know, who's the pitcher from the 70s, yep, who was the oldest pitching coach in baseball last I looked, who is also, yes, perhaps the most innovative. And that he came, you know, he worked for the Cardinals when Jeff Luno was there. And like we were saying earlier, for all the stuff that the Astros may have been doing against the rules, they were also very, very smart in seeing where a lot of this was heading and getting out in front of it.
Did you get a sense of, so Johnny Sane, teammates with Warren Spahn there at with the Milwaukee Braves, one of the greatest lefties of all time. Did you get a sense that Sane was that way as a player or became that way as a coach?
Well, you know, he was that way as a pitcher, too. He pitched a lot during the war years, you know, when he was when he was serving overseas, and you know, just learned a lot about pitch, about how to make the ball move and all that stuff we were just talking about. So he was pretty, he was very much that way, or leaning that way as a player, and then he went right into coaching. He went right from, you know, pitching for the Yankees to being their pitching coach in the early 60s, and you know, but he never stayed in one place very long because no one really knew how to deal with him. Like, they liked the results, but they didn't really. He was very headstrong, and you know, he'd carry motivational audio tapes and on the road with him and everything. Yeah. So like, he just thought of things so differently that he wasn't the kind of guy, like, he wasn't the coach's drinking buddy. You know, that's what coaches were. Yeah. They were the manager's drinking buddy to go out after the games, and he just he marched to a different drum, as the cliche goes, and so soon enough he was, you know, he'd go through New York and then he'd go through Minnesota and then he'd go through Detroit and he'd go through the White Sox, and everywhere he went he's making 20 game winners and making these guys better. But the owners didn't he always clashed at some point, and you know, was usually out of there.
Wow. Well, you mentioned that that Carlton was aware of kind of training methods and sort of forward thinking in that regard. One of the reasons why is because of his time with the Cardinals and watching Bob Gibson, right? Isn't that part of it?
Oh yeah, yeah. He loved. I mean, you know, Carlton started in the '67 World Series, but in the '68 World Series, he was kind of an afterthought. And you know, he didn't have that great a year, and they were playing in a series in Japan after the season, and he decided to put into use the Bob Gibson slider because he's lefty on lefty. He threw it at Sadahara O, and after O would hit a couple home runs off him, and it was really effective, and O jumped back in the box, and you know, the pitch was coming right at his ribs and then slashed right over the plate. Mm-hmm. And then lefty knew he had a real weapon, but he also observed how hurt Gibson was all the time, and all the pain that Gibson had to pitch through, and he didn't want to deal with that pain. He wanted to do it pain free as much as possible. And so, you know, where that's kind of that's where the idea to just train as religiously as he did came from. You know, and he found Gus Heffling, the former strength guy for the Rams, who came over to the Veterans Stadium when Roman Gabriel came to the Eagles, because he, you know, so it just, a lot of stuff had to come together, but the underpinning of it was, I want to throw like Gibson, I want to throw that pitch like Gibson, but I don't want to be hurt all the time, and I don't want to be shot up with, you know, horse steroids and
yeah,
whatever,
yeah,
putting into his body to get Gibson out there on the mound. And so, I mean, Gibson had obviously an unbelievable career, but he stopped at 251 wins, and Carlton it up with 329 and more starts by a lefty than anybody in history. Last guy to throw 300 innings, first guy to get four Cy Youngs. I mean, he was legit, man, and he was the reason that I fell in love with baseball and pitching at a very young age.
And it was the slider, right? I mean, how eager were you to kind of tell that? I know it's the first chapter of your book, and I imagine that's for a reason, just like the cutter is the last chapter of
right.
the book because of the
right.
practitioner who came at the end of the best practitioner of it came at the end of the game. So, how? So, I mean, it was from the slider that this book was born.
Yeah, I just loved watching that pitch and then how he would throw those high fastballs and those wicked sliders and. And so he was, Carlton was the number one guy I had to get for the book. He was first on my wish list. And so, you know, I appealed to a lot of Phillies, some Phillies folks who I knew from back in the day you know, and talked to his business associate or his business manager or whatever, or his agent, whatever, a guy who works very closely with him. And I got him on the phone for about 40 minutes. It was great. And saw him last year at the Hall of Fame and gave him a copy and reminded him who I was, and I think he remembered, and he told me to sign it for him, which was a surreal kind of experience to be signing something for Steve Carlton.
Let me stop you there. Have you ever asked Carlton for an autograph?
Yeah, at a Phillies charity thing in the late 80s.
Okay, so you're 1-1 now. He's asked for your autograph once.
I also got him through the mail when I was a little kid.
Really
younger than that, and then I saw him somewhere else at the vet a few years later, and I got so I think I'm 3-1 maybe.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right. That's a pretty good ratio with a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, it's anything to one when someone like that wants your autograph.
Yeah.
I don't know if he, for all I know, he left the book in his hotel room, but at the Oda Saga. But
that's great.
Yeah, it was very nice of him to accept it and to ask for my autograph and you know, and to talk to me in the first place because he doesn't do a lot of interviews. That's for sure.
Yeah. I'm up 2 on him. Or I have twice as many Kepner autographs as he does. Then, so I look at it that way. I have a book signed and a baseball card signed. So
baseball,
I like
right? Yeah. You're getting your card this year, so
we'll see. We'll see. Yeah, well, I'm flattered most of all, but like it's kind of it's cool. I'm very flattered by it. So we'll see how that turns out. Hopefully they pick a flattering photo, right? That's what I should be nervous about.
Well, you know, it's cool. What's really cool is you end up seeing that there's some collectors who just want to get everything signed, and so I've gotten a lot of. And you will too. You'll get a lot of mail, you know, self-addressed stamp envelopes. Will you please sign my card? So that's a real trip because I used to do that all, you know, 88, 89. I sent out to so many players.
So did I.
Just to get those back. And now people are sending them to you. It's really fun.
I think I'm going to send one to Pat Neshek if it happens.
Nice.
After all the conversations we had about baseball cards. Well, baseball cards play a part in your book, you have a bunch of hidden gems in the K on the cover. I know you took a lot of time doing that. Is it the same with the paperback cover? Did you get to sneak in some of those?
I thought about doing different because. You know, they designed it a little differently. This is like the green version, and they designed it a little differently. But they kept the card as a part of the design structure. They don't have the same 27 that I had in the K, and yes, 27 baseball number. They don't have the same number, and I thought about like changing them. You know, and I looked into a whole bunch of different cards, or I put different guys on this one. But then I like, you know, I picked those cards for a reason for the first time, and I really like them. So they got, I think, 20 of them, or they got a lot of them in. You know, I made sure I got the Astros on there with the J.R. Richard rainbow uniform, and I made sure we get Carlton front center, and I made sure we got, Kent Colby on there with the aviator shades.
Yeah.
I had some personal favorites, but I made sure it got in there. But yeah, no, there's, as you know, there's all, a whole lot of little Easter eggs.
That's fantastic.
I made sure to get the, you know, I wanted to get Randy Johnson as a Mariner and Nolan Ryan as an Angel because I covered the Mariners and the Angels. I had to get a brown Padres uniform in there because I love that uniform. I had to get the Astros.
the Rainbow.
Rainbow. I had to get Carlton 82 because that was my first year following it. So I had all these. You know, I got Mike Mussina in there. I got Roy Halladay celebrating the no hitter on his card because I write about that in the book. A lot of fun stuff in there.
Yeah, some of the best. One of my favorite things too is the titles of the different chapters. I have three that are my favorite. The knuckleball grabbing the wing of a butterfly. I just like that description.
Thanks.
The screwball, the Sasquatch of baseball. Again, I like that description. My favorite is the changeup, and also it might be my favorite pitch. I'm not sure. I guess I really should commit to a favorite pitch. You should inspire me to do that. But the changeup description is a dollar bill hooked on a fishing line. I like the notion of that, you know, where it's just yanked back.
Thank you. Yeah, I tried to pick something. I always find it clever when, like, an album is named after a line in a song as opposed to a song, like how Nirvana, Nevermind. Yeah. There's no song called Nevermind, but they say Nevermind within one of the songs. And I just thought that was kind of cool, kind of fun. So I wanted to just use one thing as the head of the as the title of the chapter, from a line somewhere within the chapter. You know, so you'll come across that line in the chapter and say, "Oh, that was the title." You know, you'll come across reading it and you'll say, "Oh, that was the title of the chapter." So.
And through many of these chapters, you do get some cameo appearances, even some starring roles from Cardinals. And so I thought I'd ask you about, obviously, you know, Bob Gibson with his slider is famous. Wainwright with his curveball, right? I mean, is he the game's modern master of the curveball? Would you say he's that in that group?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, who offhand, you know, who threw the most percentage of curveballs. I would guess Rich Hill. You know, or there's another guy too. Offhand, I don't know. McCullers didn't pitch last year, but of course McCullers threw it 24 times in a row to seven against the Yankees. But I think probably Wainwright's the guy who's best known for it, and has had, you know, he's had one of the longest careers at this point of any active pitcher. So probably, you know, and he threw the famous one to Beltran in the 06. We all remember. Although he ended the World Series slider.
Against Brandon Hinge. Yeah, three consecutive ones.
So
he knew you were watching.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so it may be him, but yeah, there's a lot of Cardinal stuff in there. Obviously, the Cardinals being so successful over the years, you know, even old time guys, you know, Grover Cleveland Alexander and Burley Grimes and guys like that. But you know, getting to talk to Gibson and getting to talk to Bruce Sutter and Carlton and Wainwright, those were, I'm pretty sure there's others in there too. That was a lot of fun. And Sutter was a real private guy. He didn't really have much interest in talking, but then I told him that I went up to, or I emailed him again, and I said, like, I went up to the Hall of Fame and looked into your into the file on Fred Martin, the coach who taught you your fastball, and there was very little in there. There's a couple of stories, but, you know, I feel like I need to know more about this guy who died in 1979 and never really got the acclaim because he just died too young. And, you know, and Sutter, in his Hall of Fame speech, talked about him, and Sutter, in interviews, was always mindful of giving credit to the guy who taught it to him, but he just hasn't been around in a long time to tell it. And so, and that idea really engaged him, and so we talked a lot about Fred Martin and trying to bring him back to life, because I wanted to make sure to give credit to all the great coaches. Dave Duncan I talked to, you know, Johnny Sane and Johnny Padres and Fred Martin, you know, three coaches who have died, you know, but they still had so much influence on pitchers. So I wanted to make sure I gave coaches their due. And then Sutter and I had a real nice talk about Fred Martin.
That's awesome. And the splitter chapter is called Through the Trap Door, which makes a lot of sense. And I find it interesting today, you know, the Cardinals signed Sungwon Oh a couple of years ago, and he's the all-time saves leader in KBO history, and he's back now in KBO. But he had a splitter, and now the Cardinals have Gungyung Kim, a lefty out of Korea. He probably will open the season when the season does open in the rotation. We'll see how that plays out. But he was online to do that, and he had really won that role. And he's got a splitter. And you know, just the international flavor of that pitch now because of who does it best. Just a quick aside, the curveball guy that you're talking about, the only pitcher, and I looked this up not too long ago, the only pitcher with a higher percentage of curveballs than Wainwright last season was Charlie Morton with the Rays.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, of course.
So
Charlie's.
Well, you brought up coaches. And your book also got me thinking about that in the sense of, like, you know, Dave Duncan and saying right along there with, like, on the hitting side, Charlie Lau. You know, do you think that the stories that come from your book, the stories that we know about coaches, that it leads as a pathway to Cooperstown eventually for coaches?
I don't know, because it's been so long and they've never been put in there, but I don't see why they wouldn't be. I think it's crazy that they're not. Same with scouts, but they're just two part baseball family who are not recognized with the writers and broadcasters are not actually Hall of Famers. We don't have plaques, but there is a display, and you get to make a speech that weekend. And then I feel like at the very least, there should be, you know, an annual coaches award or an annual scouts award or something at the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So you could say Hall of Fame coach, Hall of Fame scout as a modifier, if not as a true Hall of Famer in the plaque gallery. I don't understand it. But I feel like there'd be a lot of, you know, there'd be a lot you'd have to include. And it'd be largely objective or subjective, but someone like a Johnny Sainer, Johnny Padres, who both had a memorable playing career and coaching career. I feel like that's somewhere that the Hall of Fame, it's kind of a gap, something missing there. That those guys who have those hybrid careers who are just enormously impactful figures. You know, Billy Martin or Dusty Baker, Lou Piniella, guys who sort of have...
Yeah, Lou Piniella's a great example.
Big impact as a coach, big impact as a player, maybe not quite enough of either to be a Hall of Famer, but they're much more significant historically than a lot of those guys who are in the plaque gallery. So it's a little odd, but, you know, it's imperfect, but it's the best. It's still pretty, still pretty Hall of Fame. I hate to criticize it at all because it's so great. But but I do feel like that's a category of person that's missing. It's the longtime baseball, Jim Cott, you know, broadcaster all these years, like people who stay in the game and make a huge impact, but they don't fit in either category.
You have somebody who agrees with you in the background. That's barking by acclamation.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's...
That's okay.
We got three dogs, so...
It's magic. Funny. Yeah. No, I think you have Red Shandies and Joe Torre as possible kind of, you know, guys who are opening that door, but it doesn't happen regularly enough. I mean, Red got in, you know, as a player, and Torre got in as a manager, but clearly their other roles influence both of those elections.
Yes,
those are
really good examples of that for sure.
Yeah, it's just not enough. Okay, so I want to ask you about two things about the book. Then first, one that we just kind of touched on there, Dave Duncan. What was your sense, or how did you walk away from that conversation? Because, like you talk about with coaches, sometimes it can be nebulous. With scouts, it can be nebulous. Like, how do you rate their Hall of Fame career? I think with Dave Duncan and the number of Cy Youngs he had, the ERA titles, and just, we could probably calculate the millions of dollars that he saved teams because he was able to take a pitcher on a one-year deal and turn him into something. Or, heck, millions of dollars he made pitchers. I mean, I saw him. You know, he has a pair on a one-year deal or come here under control, kind of a forgotten pitcher, and then leave, often signed by the Brewers for $40 million or more. So, Jeff Suppan, Kyle Loesch come to mind. So, Joel Pinheiro was another one who just, you know, Duncan said, hey, just throw the sinker over and over again. He had a one-seam sinker. Throw it over again. Just give me one game. Go out there and throw it every pitch, and let's see what happens. And I think it was like a spring training game. He got through four innings on whatever, 17, 19 pitches, and was like, I should probably throw this pitch all the time. You're right, Dave. What was your conversation with him like?
Well, it was great. I mean, I'm you know, pretty tight with Shelley Duncan, his son,
yeah.
Conversation with the Yankees. So, it was great, and I had a ton of respect for Dave. And Tony La Russa has always made sure to include Dave in explaining how successful he's been.
Yeah.
But I looked at guys whose careers were revived and going nowhere. Dave Stewart and Dennis Eckersley, who just became hugely impactful pitchers when their careers seemed to be over just about. I think the prevailing thought now of that sinkers are not what sinkers are out of vogue now. That kind of clashes with Dave's theories, but certainly there is a lot of sinker is still a big pitch. It always has been throughout baseball history, and I thought to do a summation of baseball history in that pitch, the sinker, he won a ton of games. His teams won a ton of games with a pitching staff that was very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
He was great. I know he's been through a lot, but he's the kind of guy who would fall into that category of major longtime influence because he was a strong player there for some world championship teams with Oakland.
I hope that the Cardinals put Dave Duncan in the Hall of Fame at some point in time in the near future. They have a route for that. The owner has a choice, while the committee gets to pick players and the fans get to select players. The owner has a choice, and that's how George Kissel is in, for example. And to me, Dave Duncan fits that category. And in the future, in the coming years, Jose Oquendo will fit that category. But the Cardinals ought to do Dave Duncan right by putting him in the plaque in the Hall of Fame. I hope he does.
Yeah, they really should. And the Cardinals have such a great tradition of instruction there with George Kissel and how highly they regard him. And just the fact that they would give the managing job to Mike Schilt shows how deeply they believe in that coaching, the importance of coaching.
Yep.
That'd be really fitting.
Unless you want me to. I wasn't going to ask the cliche question for your favorite story from your book, unless you want me to ask. Do you want to tell your favorite story from the book? I do have a question, though, that maybe is a bit of a, excuse the pun, a curveball for your book.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. All right, here goes. We all know, and we talked about it, your fondness for the slider. What was the story you uncovered as you reported this book, or even as you wrote this book and revisited some of the reporting, that changed your view of a pitch and made you more fond of it? What legend or tale or, what made you more appreciative of a particular pitch? Please say nothing.
Well, I like to think that I really appreciated all of them going into it.
Well, maybe that's a good question then. Like, what history deepened? What fondness deepened once you were able to kind of, again, pardon the pun, but retrace the seams of a pitch's history?
I always loved the curveball, even though Carlton threw a slider. As a high school pitcher and a media game pitcher, I've always loved the curveball. I love the difference in the velocity, how it's a different looking, different shape pitch. And hearing great pitchers like Wainwright and Nolan Ryan and John Lester, talk about how throwing the curveball at a young age is not inherently dangerous, and that Wainwright talking about how you really, it's actually better to learn it when you're young because it's a different kind of throw than introducing it later
and you're like, now you're used to throwing it one way, and you got to sort of tilt the ball toward your head rather than toward the pitcher, toward the plate. I appreciate and like the curveball even more, because I feel like knowing that that is a safe motion, and just the fact that it's so different, like, you know, you're trying to get serious top spin rather than back spin, like most other pitchers. I mean, the knuckleball, you want no spin, basically. But just the idea of trying to topspin a ball like that, and all the colorful ways to describe it. I think there's no excuse not to have one. Just as a get me over free strike, you know, because I feel like pitchers are smart enough to tell when the hitter is no way going to swing at that. At a curveball, if you haven't shown it or whatever, you just be able to show it and get a free strike with it. I think there are certain points in the game where that would be helpful. So, and hearing Carl Erskine tell me about talking with Three Finger Brown about his mangled hand and how that allowed him to throw a better curveball because he didn't have an index finger to get in the way. I thought that was great to be able to talk to someone who knew Three Finger Brown. That was a lot of fun, man. That was unexpected.
All right, then I got to ask you, what was the favorite story you uncovered? The one you didn't know?
Well, that one for one thing. You know that always Three Finger as my favorite. Yeah, the Three Finger Brown.
That's awesome
story. But I mean, there's little stories all throughout. I mean, I enjoy sometimes just opening up to a page and remembering where I got that interview done or why I wanted to explore that, or just, you know, what that guy said. I just, you know, I think of Steve Rogers and you know, his coach Cal McLish, who would say, just get out front and get whippy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the wisdom within that, of how you do need a whip-like action at the end of your arm.
The
how primitive it was to just tell that to a kid and expect him to know what to do. So it's, I love those stories of those old-time baseball guys who were really, really wise, but maybe not as good communicators as the guys now are. So
I just love
seeing how things changed throughout history. But really, to go through and pick it up on any page and learn something. To hear Earl Hershiser talk about, you know, throwing through the strings at Dodger Town as a young kid with Koufax and Drysdale watching, and to be able to talk to these guys about their craft was just so great, because that's players like talking about what they do. They like being listened to, and because they get enough people, fans or reporters, who think they know what they're doing out there, who think they know a lot more than we do. And I think to have someone ask them about how they do what they do, how they became great, how they mastered that, I don't think the players hear enough of that, of those how questions, those why questions, because that puts the interviewer in a position of not knowing something. You know, of those, like, well, I don't know so much about the sport that I cover. I don't know. There's a whole lot that I don't know about what you do, and I think players, most of them, really appreciate people wanting to know more about what they do.
Yeah, that's well put. That's really well put. Yeah, the how and the why. I mean, you just covered everything. I mean, you brought us back to the very beginning when we were all discussing about, you know, having debates about accessing clubhouse availability and stuff like that, you know, just 10 days ago. And that's it. It gives a chance to ask how and why. When I was a Boy Scout, Tyler, going on camping trips and backpacking trips and everything like that, I would always tuck a book, depending on the length of the trip, but I would always carry a book, and a lot of time the books were these like short story books or 2-minute mystery books or things like that, that if you could, you could read on your own in small samples, or, you know, over around a campfire, you'd have campfire stories, and this was a way to do it. You'd have these the, you know, these short little tales to tell to entertain as you made s'mores and stuff. And it struck me that your book is sort of like a campfire tale. You can pick it up anywhere. You can open it up, pass out marshmallows and chocolate and graham crackers and say, tonight I'm going to tell you the tale of the knuckleball. Tonight we're going to talk about the spitball. And let me tell you the story of, you know, razor blades and goop. And so I mean that's definitely what it is it's campfire tales for a baseball fan, and that makes it perfect for these days where we have to social distance, but we can still gather as families to tell stories. And so your book, Kay, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches, is perfect. It's fireside chat baseball stories.
Oh, well, that's very nice of you to say that. I appreciate it. Sorry, we thought if we kicked around the name Behind the Seams, like,
I know,
but it didn't
I really wanted that.
But now that it's in paperback, it can be taken on backpacks and scout trips and stuff. It's a little lighter now, so they, you know, and you still have the photos. They're not in glossy color like the hardback. But I took all those photos very, very seriously, all the way down to the cut lines, very seriously. Tried to have a lot of fun with them. So yeah, I had to get everything just right, and everything was just right except for one thing, and the only thing was, it was a page that I didn't see. I didn't get to edit it because it was the inside jacket cover, and a friend of mine took the author photo of me, and they had to put like copyright with his name or whatever, and they misspelled his name, and I'm like,
no.
I mean, no one would know. He's just like, you know, he's a fan, like, you didn't let me see the inside jacket cover. You know, you write an article, and then the next day it comes out, and you're like, oh man, I got that fact wrong, and then you're, you know, and like with a book, like, it's there forever,
right? Right.
You know, luckily that didn't really happen.
That's awesome. I still think the best photo you've ever had taken of you is the one for your baseball card. That's just a personal opinion.
Yes, that was Ansel Adams.
It was. I like to think of it as my best baseball card work. You know, yes. It's definitely number one.
And I'm airbrushed too. They airbrushed out So I even got a little of the Topps airbrush treatment.
Nice. Congratulations on that. So,
well, right, airbrushed out my Eagles logo on my lanyard, so I wasn't really happy about that. But to be airbrushed by Topps is an honor.
I hope they airbrush in like a jawline for me.
Yeah, right.
That's the hope. So, all right. Well, thanks, Tyler. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for social distancing with me here. Talking a little baseball and joining the best podcast in baseball. It's K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches, and it's available on Amazon or any of your local bookstores that are doing curbside service or delivery, as they are here in St. Louis. We have multiple bookstores here in St. Louis that are doing curbside and delivery, just to meet the needs and try to, you know, also stay in business during this time. So K is available at all those places, right?
Yep. Everywhere books are sold. If you would rather listen to it, it's the audio version too, if you can stand my voice. I did that. So yeah, it's large print. There's a large print version. So yeah, there's all kinds of ways to consume it. But yeah, thank you very much.
No problem.
For having me on, man.
Thank you.
Always happy to join you, my friend.
You can also find Kepner's work in the New York Times. You may be familiar with that. NYTimes.com or the actual old, robust, no longer gray lady, you know, the newspaper. So, Tyler, thank you. We'll be in touch. I'm sure we'll talk a lot during this stoppage of baseball.
Absolutely. Let's hope it's as short as possible.
Yeah, for everybody's sake. I hope so. It means the country's getting healthier, and when baseball is back, that means we're through it and we can celebrate again.
A special thanks to friend, author, and New York Times national baseball columnist Tyler Kepner for joining the podcast. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch and SCLToday.com will continue to bring the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design, throughout this baseball stoppage. It's going to be a weekly podcast, and we'll see what creativity we can come up with to bring you podcasts throughout this time. But at least you know it will be there. The best podcast in baseball is brought to you again by Closets by Design. Get organized with Closets by Design of St. Louis. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BYDESIGN. Closets by Design of St. Louis, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. You can find the best podcast in baseball and all of the constant Cardinals coverage, which really we should rename now the continuing Cardinals coverage, at STLtoday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. Just because there are games does not mean there's not things to cover. So you'll find all our group here at the Post-Dispatch providing content throughout the week online and in print of Cardinals and baseball and any of the news that comes up during this stoppage in play due to the global pandemic that is the coronavirus. You can also find other podcasts there, including the Mizzou podcast, a Blues podcast, and a whole other host of podcasts that are coming from STLtoday.com. You can also find the best podcast in baseball at iTunes, where you can listen to individual episodes, download individual episodes. You can also subscribe to the podcast. I cannot say this enough. Subscriptions make the sponsorships possible, and sponsorships make the weekly podcast possible. It's the reason why we'll continue with this through the next coming months, wherever they may lead. So also rate and review the podcast. Tell me a little bit about what you like about the podcast, what you don't, and we'll do our best to try to make it better. The best podcast in baseball exists only because of the community of listeners that have developed around BPIB. I cannot say thank you enough, especially now as we're kind of bound by this distance, but have a shared interest. Mine is trying to bring a quality podcast to you and be responsive to the community that means a lot to BPIB. The best podcast in baseball will return next week with a new episode. Until then, stay healthy. Stay at a comfortable distance, but most of all, stay healthy. We'll talk to you then. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. This has been the best podcast in baseball. See you soon. Hope to see baseball soon.
No, the dog's fine.
Who cares?
The dog is a star. Is the dog in the audiobook?
No, I did that on Arthur, but I do mention the dog in there because his name is Lefty. So.
Oh, there you go. The dog's name is Lefty, because of course.
Yeah, Lefty's after Carlton.
Will you have another dog named Slider eventually?
No, I'm thinking, like, how many more 80 fillies? Because we had one dog named Rosie for a little while, so if there's 3 of the 25, I've got, like, should I do I don't know, how do you name a dog after, like, Dick Ruthven or Bake McBride? Maybe Bake.